Hi Jim, thank you so much for inviting me back on the program. As you know, I've spent about 30 years of my life looking into many of the major assassinations, false flag operations, the big cases like JFK, Robert Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, Malcolm X, 9/11, all the mass shootings and so on. And so I've spent a great deal of time looking into different assassinations and assassins and how the CIA have been behind so much mayhem in the world, and also the so-called New World Order, how this little group of people have been behind so many of these assassinations that they look like they're not connected, but once you start seeing behind the scenes, we are talking about the same power structure behind these eliminations of people, and we're even talking about them using the same team. Earlier in some of your programs, I've been going into great details about especially a group called Operation 40. This group was very central in the JFK assassination, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and so on. And some of these people have been very active all the way from the early 60s all the way up until today. I mean, most of them has died. They've lived by the gun, and they died by the gun, just like the old gunslingers. But there's still some of them around, and they've been very, very active. So, well, anyway, today I would like to take you back to the 1960s. This was, if you remember, a decade that was so incredibly important for what has happened in the world since then, because this is the time, for one thing, when JFK was taken out. It was when Martin Luther King was taken out, when Robert Kennedy was taken out, and when the hope of the world was just crushed by these very violent acts. It was also a time where people came from being very, very naive, like before the Beatles, before the Rolling Stones, before the whole rock era. And then within just a few years, the United States, I would say, was taken over by this very brutal cabal that is still in power. After they killed JFK, they were the ones who were behind the whole thing with the Vietnam War and so many other wars. I mean, we are up in the hundreds now that has been started by the U.S. and by the same people, very, very involved in the military-industrial complex and so on a global scale. So I would like to take you back into the early 1960s and show you some things that most people are not aware of what was going on. And especially in different areas that is not normally connected to assassinations and these brutal areas. One of the things that this elite has been doing for decades and decades is to focus on areas that can really affect public, the general population. Nowadays they're into the music business, the film industry big time, and media. They're controlling media to a large extent, just because they know that is one of the major ways and the best ways to really get to ordinary people, you know, just get into their subconscious. And over the years, quite a few so-called rock stars and pop stars and so on have been eliminated by this the same group because, well, there are different reasons. One of them had been people like John Lennon or Bob Marley, or people that have been standing up for peace and unity, all these beautiful things that most people are dreaming about, a world in absolute harmony and so on. But when it comes to this cabal, that is a very big threat against their agenda. Their agenda, always the same: death, control, and destruction. That is what they're aiming for. And anyone who comes in their way will be dealt with, and many times in a very, very brutal way. And if they can't scare the crap out of you and get you back and get back in line that way, They will harass you, threaten you, and they might even kill you. Many, many, many people have died. Many people have been suicided, and so on. So it is a very dangerous task to stand up against this group of people. I myself have, I must say, I've paid a high price. I have two friends who was murdered in Sweden because our investigations were getting too deep into the Olof Palme case. That was the Swedish Prime Minister that was gunned down in the streets of Stockholm in 1986. I've also had to leave my home country. I left Sweden in the year 2000, and I'm now living in Spain because I was threatened and I did not feel safe at all in Sweden. So, anyway, I would like to take you back, like I said, to the early 1960s. Please, if you can remember, this was the time where, like I said, people were very naive in many ways. It was a time where the Beatles' fringe was shocking the world. I mean, you can imagine, just a haircut, I mean, it wasn't even a long haircut or anything like that, was really shocking the world. So it was at that level of naivety, and that was also when the JFK assassination was carried out and so on. And just after JFK was killed in November of 1963, there's quite a few researchers now coming forward saying that there might be a possibility. I mean, there's even MI6 agents and so on that claims that this is the truth, that Beatles was a creation of the Tavistock Institute. One of the reasons was to divert the attention away from the JFK assassinations. Because when you look at the whole Beatles phenomena, it follows just a few months after the JFK killing. That is when the whole world suddenly looked left to the UK and to this wonder that just came from absolute nowhere. It was also a time where the music industry in the States were focused on cities on the East Coast, mostly like New York. It was in Nashville and in Memphis as well. This was the music center. At that time, there was no real, there was no studios, there was no music scene for musicians and so on in Los Angeles and in California. Not at all the way it is now. And in 1964, we're now talking about just a few months after the assassination of JFK, and when the whole Vietnam War was started by Johnson signing the order just after, I mean, JFK hadn't even died. I mean, he was dead, but he wasn't even cold. He wasn't even buried before Johnson signed the order that got the whole Vietnam War going. So at that time, after JFK had entered the scene, he had started this incredible wave of hope, and people were standing up for all of these beautiful things like peace and unity and so on. So when he was killed, the people behind this assassination suddenly had a massive problem with people confronting them, saying, "My God, what's going on here? You need to look into what actually happened here, and we need to stop this Vietnam War before it gets out of control, before it really gets going." So this whole anti-war movement was becoming very strong. So when you look at the CIA and COINTERPRO and other organizations like that, the FBI and so on, in the mid-60s, when all of these things were happening, the whole situation as well, especially in the States, were very, very turmoil. There was this whole thing with the black and white, the races clashing, and like apartheid in the States. And it was coming to a point where there was almost a big risk for a civil war in the States. So the power behind the takeover, this coup d'etat, which the JFK was a major, the assassination of JFK was a major part in this whole movement forward. suddenly had a big, big problem with this anti-war movement. So the question was, how were they going to deal with it? How could they divert the attention away from this war, away from this whole thing that was planned to make absolute billions for the whole military-industrial complex, for the government, for all the mob and all of these things, where the whole drug movement and drug smuggling that was planned from the Golden Triangle and through the Vietnam War was being planned to make absolute billions for so many people involved. How could they divert the attention away from this and also discredit the whole anti-war movement? Taking that in respect, I will take you now to 1964. There is a small little area just north of just outside Los Angeles. It's quite a beautiful area, rocky, soft hills, very foresty, beautiful little thing. The area I'm going to explain to you about is very, very small. We're only talking about a few square miles. So please keep that into consideration while I'll start explaining to you about this. In this little area, very few roads, very few buildings, very few houses, and not many people living there. In this little area, there was what was called the Lookout Mountain Laboratory. This was originally a fortified air defense center built in 1941. It was a secluded 2.5 acre off what is now called the Wonderland Park Avenue, hidden from view and surrounded by an electrified fence. This was a top secret military intelligence facilities. And in 1947, this was the world's only completely self-contained movie studio with 100,000 square feet of floor space, sound stages, screening rooms, film processing labs, editing facilities, an animation department, and 17 climate control film vaults, plus a helicopter pad and bomb shelter. I mean, we're talking about a very top secret military installations hidden up among the hills in this little area here, this little canyon. Now, the Lookout Mountain Laboratory is said to have produced some 19,000 classified motion pictures. 19,000! That is more than all the Hollywood studios combined. And this actually would make this canyon the motion picture capital of the world, but it was run by the US Air Force. Now, I ask you, have you ever heard about this? I know I, for one, had only heard about it not long ago, a year or so ago and so on. It was also a research and development center with cutting-edge technology and advanced research. And you had people like the producer and director John Ford. You had actors like Jimmy Stewart, Howard Hawks, Ronald Reagan, Bing Crosby, Walt Disney. I mean, Disney later very involved in many of these things. And Marilyn Monroe, many other people like that. I think also John Wayne was there. They were given clearance to work on undisclosed projects. As far as I know, none of these have ever spoken about it, but they were still contracted. And this facility remained unknown until the early 1990s. I just want to point out that at the exact same time that this was revealed was the time when the so-called Gladio was revealed here in Europe, where there was a massive big scandal starting in Italy exposing this ghost army that was created by the CIA after the Second World War, with all the NATO countries having like a ghost army in place, so that should any of the NATO countries be invaded, the whole resistance movement would already be in position with hidden gun depots, fuel depots, food, radio, all of these things would already be in position, so that the royal families or the government of whatever country we're talking about would be smuggled to London, and then from London they would be there to be in total control of the whole resistance movement. And this Gladio movement was also called Stay Behind, since these troops were left behind and would stay behind to defend against whatever enemy we're talking about. But at the same time, when the Cold War turned out that the threat from the East was not as bad as they had expected, they were suddenly standing there with this incredibly big army. I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands of cells of 8 to 10 people, all connected in a hidden network. Suddenly there was no reason for this whole army. So what happened instead was that the CIA and other agency had meetings, and they decided to come up with what is called the strategy of tension. With that strategy of tension, what they were aiming at was to inflict fear into modern society by committing loads of violent atrocities, so-called terror acts, mass shootings, bombings of train stations, blowing up buses, mass shootings in supermarkets, riots at football stadiums, and so on. What they wanted to was to inflict fear into the man in the street, so that he would live in constant fear and would welcome more and more militarized police force, more and more surveillance, more and more control, and willingly give up more and more of his civil liberties and human liberties and so on. So one of the people that was part of building up this whole Stay Behind network in Europe was William Colby. He was later the director of the CIA. Anyway, so this very top secret military installation up in this very hidden little canyon just outside Los Angeles was not exposed until more or less the exact same time as the Gladio network was exposed here in Europe. So we go back and we start looking at this little canyon, and there's one researcher, his name is David McGowan, who's done incredible work. I must really recommend him on his research, and he's written a book called Weird Secrets of the Canyon. It's about this canyon called Laurel Canyon. He's also written another book called Program to Kill. Very, very excellent work. I can highly recommend it. Anyway, so this little canyon, while this military installation was working there without most people knowing about it, this canyon was also, there was quite a few of movie stars all the way since the 1920s. There were people like Houdini, Tom Mix, and other people like that who had been living up there in a secluded area where they could stay away from the normal public eye and so on. But in the early 1960s, suddenly this changed. And we're talking at the exact same time when, after JFK was taken out and the whole Vietnam War was started and so on. For some very strange reason, suddenly it was like the Pied Piper was standing in this small little canyon playing his flute, and if there had been an invisible force pulling together upcoming musicians from all over the states, or mostly from around Washington D.C., were being, like when you read their memoirs and so on, these people that would very soon become world famous rock stars and so on, nobody really explains why they went to this canyon, but everybody just by coincidence started going west and started meeting up in this small little canyon. So we look at this, and one of the people in the center of this whole thing was Frank Zappa and his wife. Frank Zappa, and he was living in what was called a log cabin. It was a massive, massive house, a five-level home that featured a 2,000 square foot living room with three massive chandeliers and an enormous living room where there was a fireplace all the way from the floor all the way up to the ceiling, you know. Incredibly big house. And in this house and some of the houses just nearby, many, many future rock stars came for no apparent reason. Everybody just came to this little canyon. We're talking about like groups like the Byrds, the Mamas and the Papas, Frank Zappa and the Mothers and Invention, Arthur Lee, Buffalo Springfield, the Doors, the Monkees, the Eagles were soon to arrive there as well, Joni Mitchell, Judy Collins, Carole King, and so on. And also Zappa, who was in the whole center of this, he started signing, after a while, he started signing people like Captain Beefheart and Alice Cooper and so on. And when you look at it, I will soon come into describing a lot of very, very strange things around these musicians, because most of them have very, very similar backgrounds. More or less all of these people, and many others I'm going to mention as well, have parents. They had parents that were very much into military intelligence, to MK Ultra. They were, many of them were high-level admirals, generals, and so on. And many of them had grown up very close or on military bases, very close to or on military bases, and so on. And now, for some unknown reason, suddenly all of them were coming like lemurs, crossing the whole of the states and just gathering in this tiny little canyon here. So, the big question is, was this just a coincidence, or was there something behind it? And how big are the chances that all of these upcoming rock stars that were standing up, you know, up against the establishment, and they were fighting for peace officially and all of these things, that they were living just side by side with one of these top, top secret military installations, with this massive, massive unknown, like Hollywood studio, making all of these classified movies. Very, very odd, to say the least. And when we get back, I'm going to describe more in details what was going on.
Even Bush admits that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Our own FBI acknowledged it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to 9/11. But if Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and if Osama had nothing to do with 9/11, then who did it?
Who did it?
The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer. Discover the big picture. Learn what we know now. Find out what it means. 11 experts contribute to exposing the truth as the anatomy of an atrocity. Edited by James H. Fetzer. Buy it now if you have the courage to face the truth. Just don't think you're going to like it. The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer.
Before the break, we were talking about that there was an absolute new music scene that was taking shape in a geographically and socially isolated community just outside Los Angeles. This was in the spring of 1964, a very heavily wooded, rustic, serene, beautiful area that just separates the LA Basin from the San Fernando Valley. Just one little road going up the hills, up through these beautiful hills, and along these narrow roads, there's a handful of street houses. There are more, but not a lot. I mean, not very many houses. And in the middle of all of this, this top secret U.S. naval military installation with a super duper high tech motion picture studio with all the different installations that can be used for whatever, and they had produced some 19,000 of incredible films. I mean, I have no idea about these classified motion pictures. What are they? Have you seen them? Have I seen them? No idea, but I'm sure we have, but we have not maybe been aware of it. And why this why has it been secret for so many years? Okay, so we go back to this little canyon. It's called Laurel Canyon, like I said, just outside Los Angeles. And in the spring of 1964, suddenly musicians, singers, and songwriters suddenly began to gather, just as they were summoned by some unseen force that was just pulling them into this little canyon. In the center of all of this, we had Frank Zappa and his wife and family. And they were like the central figure that was just creating this whole scene for all of these people coming there. There was also John Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas. He was very, very central in this whole thing. And you had David Crosby from Crosby, Stills and Nash. He was also very, very central in this whole thing. And I don't know about you, Jim, but I thought that boy bands, you know, like when you create a boy band and you just you put together one blonde, one dark, one tough, one sweet, whatever, to make a constellation that would work for the general public and get as much fans, as many fans as possible, that was a new thing. But when you look at how these bands were created, we're talking about the same thing. And then once I started looking into that, I remembered that I was very aware that the Monkees were created exactly like that. And when you look at other bands, you will see a very similar pattern. I cannot prove it directly. I'm just going to point it out because to me this sounds very strange indeed. For instance, you have the group The Doors. The Doors, as far as I know, and I've been able to find out, could hardly play when they were formed as a band in Laurel Canyon. Jim Morrison, who was the lead singer, his father was the admiral that was on the warship that is said to have been attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin. You know, that whole false flag that started the whole Vietnam War. Johnson said, oh my God, we're being attacked. We have to hit back. And boom, that was the thing that got the whole Vietnam War going. At the exact same time as Admiral Morrison reported that he was being under attack, his son was on the way to this small canyon. And if you read and listen to interviews with Jim Morrison, he says repeatedly that he couldn't play an instrument, he was not interested in music, he never wrote music, really. The only songs that he ever wrote was he brought them to the canyon, like a big stack of papers with hit songs that he officially has written, but no songs afterwards ever, and no songs before it. And how did he write it down? How did he make these songs and melodies and so on, if he couldn't play an instrument, if he couldn't write music, how did he do it? You also look at other bands and you will see that there are some people in the background surrounding Frank Zappa and so on, that saw the possibility and started supplying these bands with instruments, with amplifiers, with all these things. So, and once again, they were not very good at playing. And many of the bands, when you look at the records, when they recorded it, you will see that the musicians on these records are not the people in the band, but they were musicians. Many times, some really skilled musicians from Elvis Presley's band, and there were other people just working as studio musicians that just kept moving on, playing on all the different groups' albums. And also when you go back in memoirs and so on, you read about the gigs that they did in the beginning, people said it sounded awful. The people in the bands themselves said it sounded awful. And but the records, they were the ones that sounded great. Now, in the whole center of this thing, where a whole new type of music was created within a very few square miles, there was also the so-called hippie movement started from exactly the same small few buildings in the same small canyon. Now, the man behind the whole what turned into the flower power movement and the hippie movement was a man called Vito and his dance group, the Freakies. And what they did, they were often in Frank Zappa's house and so on, and they were the ones that started with the whole way of dressing, what we now see as the hippie movement, you know, with long hair, flower in the hair, and, you know, painted hearts on the belly and all of this, and dancing like they were totally flipped out, you know, spaced out and so on. It was a small, small group coming from this canyon. And they were, every single time that a new band was being pushed forward and so on, Vito and the Freakies were there before. And they created more, what shall I say, they created more of an impact than many of the bands. So in all these clubs before the bands and while the bands were playing, people, the audience, was standing watching the dancers much more than looking at the bands. Then you see, you have this all of these bands standing up against the establishment and you know, the whole youth movement and so on. You would think that the labels that signed them would be alternative labels, you know, people that was up against the establishment and so on that really wanted to go for it. No. They were signed by the major labels like CBS and so on. So big question mark here. What made these big labels sign them up so easily and so readily? And also, the bands coming from this little canyon was giving prime time on all the big shows, the youth shows and so on, where the parents was just pulling their hair, being totally freaked out. But the major power behind this whole music scene, where there was big money as well, pushing this forward, was very much connected to the so-called establishment. So it does not equal up when you start looking at it. Also, you will see that many of the people behind this music scene were also the people that arranged, like the Monterey Pop Festival and so on, where many of these historical events where Jimi Hendrix were playing and so on took place at these big concerts and so on, the big rock shows, the first ones ever, really, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of LSD trips being passed out for free. They were given out for free. I've heard numbers between 10 and 50,000 free trips were given to the audience. Why? Why on earth? Who would do a thing like that? We're back to the CIA and COINTELPRO, I would say, very much. Who are financing this whole thing? I'm not saying that these musicians themselves have been totally aware of it, because when you look at the way they do all of these operations, normally it's totally compartmentalized, so that even people involved have no idea what's really going on and what they're part of. But I would very much suggest that there could be a very strong force behind pushing this whole movement forward to divert the attention away from the war, away from this whole civil war threat that was going on, away from all of these political battle that was going on and so on, to get people to look the other way. And many people that were involved in the anti-war movement, they were like, where the hell did the hippies come from? They just popped up like boom overnight from nowhere, and they totally discredited the whole anti-war movement, because people started laughing at them, seeing them, you know, as, my God, they're totally spaced out and drug addicts and so on. So they totally lost credibility and so on. So they defused the power behind the anti-war movement big time. Then, if we go back to this this very, very small area in Laurel Canyon, when you look at the number of deaths in this, it's unreal. Very few houses, very few streets. But when you look at people that either lived there or were connected to this area, so many of them died a very violent death. I can just mention a few ones. The comedian Lenny Bruce, who was also very much anti-war movement and standing up for things, he died there. The actress Sharon Tate, Roman Polanski's wife, who was also very much connected to this canyon, as were actors like David Carradine. I'm sorry, my head now. Anyway, I'll go back to that later on. But you had singer like Graham Parson from the International Submarine Band. You had and he was in the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers as well. You had Mama Cash Elliot, she was very central together with John Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas in the canyon. She did not, however, die in the canyon. She died in the exact room, exact same room as Keith Moon of The Who died in London. The exact same room. And that home in London was owned by Harry Nilsson, who was very in the Laurel Canyon, very much so. And he was also one of the drinking buddies of John Lennon, who later died in a very violent way. And he was quite in this canyon quite a lot as well. As were Jimi Hendrix, who also died very violently. And believe it or not, I don't know if you, it's very hard to believe, but Jimi Hendrix, before he really made it, he was actually the warm-up act before the Monkees. Can you believe it? Unreal. Anyway, we had Janis Joplin. She died just outside the mouth of the canyon, and it was almost 2 weeks after Jimi Hendrix died, very, very close to each other. Dwayne Allman and Barry Oakley from the Allman Brothers, these two died. Acton Ramon Navarro, Sal Mineo, Diane Linklater, Inger Stevens, Jay Sebring, Wojtek Frykowski, and Abigail Folger, Judith Lilsin. These were, some of them were victims from this very, very, very brutal murder that is blamed on or said to have been committed by Charles Manson and so on, in the canyon as well. There were two of these major mass murders that was committed in the canyon itself. Very, very close little area. Then you had the roadie Bruce Brary. You had the guitarist for the Byrds, Clarence White. You had Graham Nash, girlfriends Amy Gossage. You had the singer songwriter Tim Buckley, if you remember him. Phyllis Major Brownie. She was the wife of Jackson Brown. You had singer Bobby Fuller. You had chemist Gary Hinman, who was very much involved with drugs and so on. Bassist Gary Thane from Uriah Heep. Tommy Bolin from Deep Purple. Christine Hinton, Alan the Blind Owl Wilson, he was a singer of Canned Heat and so on, and a woman called Marina Elizabeth Harbour, who was carved up and tossed along the Mulholland Drive, who had a father that was very much involved in military intelligence and so on, in Germany and so on. So, what are the chances of all of these people dying so young and from such a small little area? And why were they killed? Why did they die? Were all of these just overdoses, as they were said, or accidents? What are the chances of this small little area with so many strange things going on, and then so many strange deaths as well? When you look at conspiracies, you will see that very often when people are too close to an event like that and knows too much, they will be taken care of. They will die in accidents, suicides, overdoses, whatever. Very similar to the deaths of these people. Other people that was very close to the things in Laurel Canyon was also like Roman Polanski, like I said, Jack Nicholson, very much so, Peter Fonda, who have we got more? when it comes to Roman Polanski, please also keep in mind that his wife, Sharon Tate, who was one of the victims in this awful, awful mass murder committed in the canyon, they recorded and filmed some scenes of this very, I think, very, don't like it at all, Rosemary's Baby, the film Rosemary's Baby. And that was filmed in the Dakota building, the exact same building where John Lennon was shot, who also spent a lot of time in the canyon. It seems very connected, and once you start looking into this, there's a lot of very dark things in this canyon as well. With I normally don't go into like satanic rituals and these type of things, but a lot of these things seems to be connected to this area. Also with child trafficking, pedophile rings, and snuff movies, these type of awful things connected to this canyon. There's another thing also. Many, if not all of these musicians were at the age where they should be drafted for the Vietnam War. Not one of them went. As far as I know, not a single one of them were drafted. You read their biographies and so on, they make jokes and they say, well, I pretended to be gay, I pretended to have a bad leg or something like that. The only people that got away with that came from the canyon. Normal people were sent off as cannon fodder. So what was it that was protecting these people? I mean, the establishment officially really, really disliked them and had no respect whatsoever and just wanted to see them dead. So why were they not forced to go? But they were not. And also, it was a center for drugs big time, this canyon, during the 60s. Why were the police not there? Why did they not do any raids there? Why? And also, if they were caught, like David Crosby and other people like that, when they finally got caught, I mean, there was one of them, he got caught and he thought that he was looking at like 47 years in prison. He was let out after 2 weeks. What was it that gave this protection? Why were they being protected? We will see this after the break. I will go into another area about serial killers and how these people also had this invisible protection from above. What is it that makes these people untouchable? What is it that had formed history like this? Why have they not had to be responsible for their actions like the rest of us have? And why have the establishment been covering over and protecting them? You will see that every single time they were picked up for something like drugs or whatever, they were let off the hook again and again and again. And one person that later became very infamous was Charles Manson. He was very central in these years in the canyon. And according to many of the people there, a very talented musician as well. And as far as I know, he was auditioning for the Monkees. Can you believe it? I mean, world history would have looked a lot different if they had taken him on. But people like Neil Young thought that he was absolutely super talented, and so he was blown away by his songs and so on. But instead, this man was turned around and twisted into this very, very odd behavior that was connected to what I was mentioning before with the devil worship, satanic rituals, and these brutal, brutal killings, absolute horrendous killings. Once again, when you look into these mass murders as well, you will see that there's a lot of strange things going on when it comes to the investigation, how things are covered up and how they're evidence is being manufactured or destroyed, or some very, very odd things. So we're going to go into more details after the break. So, Jim, any questions, please let me know. Otherwise, when I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. Till I get to the bottom and I see you again.
Or do you, don't you want me to make you?
Say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
see them out for dinner with their piggy wives, clutching forks and knives to eat the bacon.
One more time.
Okay, so up until now we've been talking about the rock stars and the whole rock scene in the beginning of the 60s, and how there's quite a lot of evidence starting to point towards the idea that there might have been a very strong, I wouldn't call it political force, but military force behind the whole music scene and the whole music development over the 60s. Please also remember that you got like from 1963, where people were into She Loves You, Yeah, 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 that type of music, and then only 6 years later, when the Beatles broke up after having done the whole change of music together with so many other bands, the whole flower power movement, the whole LSD, the whole drug thing that just exploded everywhere. The difference in just a very few years was just incredible. The speed of this development was just in never seen before or after. So was this made on purpose, or are these things just a coincidence? Before the break, I was talking about the strategy of tension, how the CIA after the Second World War decided to use the Gladio movement, or the Gladio Ghost Army, this very, very brutal tool of a hidden ghost army that they had at their disposal, where they decided to use this to inflict fear into society, to create an atmosphere where lawlessness and disorder were everywhere, where it would be, we're describing the situation today when terror acts and bombs and assassinations and civil massacres and football stadium tragedies are nothing really unusual. We hear about these things more or less on a weekly basis, from just like if you would go back just 10, 15 years ago before 9/11, this would be absolutely unheard of. Now this has totally escalated. So my question is this done by design, or is it just coincidence? I would strongly say that let's just look upon it as a possibility that there could be a design thought behind it. So would the CIA and other intelligence agency be morally or ethically restrained from inflicting traumas, very, very violent and very painful traumas on society? The answer would be no. They would not hesitate at all. It would be done in the name of national security and so on. So it would work very much hand in hand with their plan, their general plan, to just take over society, get total control and strangle us, get rid of all our liberties and so on, by having this outer threat from different areas, as many different areas as possible, so that people would feel threatened by everything and so on. We look back in time, and at the same time as the rock scene started, if you look at the JFK assassination, in my humble opinion, was the takeover, the big takeover when it came to this cabal. That was when they entered the scene big time. And this is also when so many different areas starts escalating, so many different agendas starts taking off and so on. And this is also the time where the so-called serial killers suddenly starts appearing, especially in the US. This phenomena, serial killer, is a very American phenomenon. It does exist in other countries, but nowhere near as in the US. So what happened there? Or once again, is it just a coincidence? Is it just that you and the US have got especially many very crazy people with very sick ideas? Or is there something other behind the whole thing? Let's have a look. When you look into many of these serial killers, once again, I would like to recommend the work of the absolute incredible researcher David McGowan. And when you look at many of these serial killers, I've spent many years tracking them down. You and I, Jim, have exposed Clyde Forshaw, Walter Tobinski, these people who have been extremely efficient when it comes to killing people in the hundreds, actually in the thousands, around many of these assassinations. And when you look at them in great detail, you will see that they have very similar backgrounds, that they've had absolute horrific childhoods where they have been going through awful, awful things, sexual abuse, violent abuse, and so on. And many of them have also grown up close to psychiatric institutions or military installations. You will see that one thing that many of them have in common is that they, like I said, they grew up in very difficult circumstances, but also many of them were very, very interested in police work or medical work, like ambulance drivers or in morgues or something like that. And also quite a few of them went from different prisons for youth installations and into psychiatric wards and stuff, where there's a big possibility that they were being used to do experiments on. Or when you also see many of these military installations where some of them grew up close by are some of the centers where MK Ultra was very strong at that time in its development. I have a friend of mine, his name is Chip Tatum. You can find him on chiptatum.com. He's a CIA whistleblower. He was a deep cover agent for 25 years for the CIA. He was a black op assassin. He was one of the Night Stalker pilots, you know, these black helicopters. He was also one of the main pilots in the Iran-Contra scandal, flying weapons out from the States and drugs into the States under the supervision of George Bush Sr. personally and Bill Clinton, among other people. But he was also one of the people involved in George Bush Sr.'s private team of assassins, where they did at least 17 missions internationally, taking out people and so on. And I asked him about these things. He did not know about the military installations, but what he did say was that he was part of flying people from some of the prisons where they took prisoners and flew them to installation in Los Alamos and also in Springfield, to Springfield, Missouri, where they were, what he mentioned as the famous doctors were doing. Whatever they were doing, he was not sure, but it had to do with mind control, it had to do with implants and so on. Now, when you look at serial killers, and you look at most people, how they look upon serial killers, most of it is based on films that we've seen made in Hollywood. When you look at Hollywood, you will see that a major part of the power behind Hollywood are the same power structure as are behind many of these assassinations. So they have a strong interest in trying to affect our subconscious into believing what they want us to believe. And the general idea about a serial killer, I think most of us think, is that it's somebody who, for some reason, he has a specific like taste when it comes to victims. It can either be the same age of women, the same hair color, the same race, the same whatever. and that he kills them in a very specific way, many times like in a ritualistic way, where maybe he has a way of positioning the body afterwards, that he does a very brutal way of killing them, very like butchering them up. And also maybe that he has tied them up in a way with a special type of knot and so on. And the FBI, who has spent, when you look at the FBI going back in history, you will see that the FBI are very deeply involved in more or less all the so-called terror acts in the States. As far as I know, Judge Napolitano pointed out very well before he was fired that all the 20, I think it was 23 at that time, the different so-called terror acts that was done in the US were all financed, equipped or trained by the FBI. So this institution that you think is there for your protection, sorry to be the bringer of bad news, they are part of the bad guys, okay? And here you have that it's the FBI that has come up with this thing called profiling. They're the ones who have suggested that this is the way serial killers work, and that by finding out exactly the patterns that they're using, this is the way that we can track them down and get hold of them and help society. So we start looking at some of these major serial killers like Ted Bundy, Henry Lee Lucas, Otis Toole, many of these, the Night Stalker, the Boston Strangler and so on. You look at them, and at least I thought that of course they would follow these patterns that I have been informed that this is how a serial killer works, that it's a specific type of look on the victim, for instance, that it's a specific type of maybe young women or children or something like that. And you look at it, you will see it is absolutely not true when it comes to these real serial killers. Absolutely not. Their victim ranges from very young children, many often, all the way up until to people, you know, in their 60s and 70s. Many of them have a mix of races. There's no specific pattern. And when you look at the CIA's Book of Assassinations, the manual of how to commit assassinations, one of the things that they recommend their own agents is to use weapons of opportunity, or take items that you can find at the crime scene and kill them with a blunt object, a screwdriver, something that makes it possible for you to enter the crime scene without a weapon on you, so that if you by any chance would be stopped or searched or anything like that, you would never be caught with a weapon on you. And when you leave the crime scene, you will leave without a weapon. Also, it is highly recommended for CIA, for the agents of this agency, to, if they do an assassination, a hit, that they use a small caliber weapon, like 22, 25 caliber weapon or something like that. And the reason for that is that a more powerful handgun, if you fire a shot to the head, the chances of the bullet passing you right through the skull without killing the victim is quite big. Contrary to what most people think, it's very possible that a bullet can pass right through your skull but without killing you. That will only take out some parts of the brain, but you will survive. So what they recommend is that you a smaller caliber weapon is used, like I said, a 22 or 25, because then the bullet is powerful enough to enter the skull but not to exit, and instead the bullet will start going ricocheting inside the skull and making maximum damage on the inside, killing the person more or less all the time. So we look at these serial killers, and what do we find? I would have thought that these butchers that they have been made out of to look like, that they would have done all of these like very brutal, sadistic killings all the time. You know, that the same killer would kill the same way. we see in these historical cases absolutely not true. It is almost like there's a lot of contract killings done and then covered up with very brutal ritualistic killings, I would say. Because many of these victims have been shot point-blank headshots with small caliber weapon, 22 most of the time, sometimes a 25 caliber, you know, exactly like these professional hits would be done. And some of these victims have been shot while being asleep, headshot, boom, 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 like this, nothing, very clean. Many times the apartments, the victims, everybody has been, it has been cleaned totally like professional, super professional. No witnesses, they haven't seen anyone enter or exit the buildings. Very clean, very professional. And then the same killer is claimed to have totally butchered some other victims. Same thing there, the victim can range from anything from children all the way up until the 70s. No racial boundaries, black, white, Asian, does not matter. You look at the these victims, and many of them have been involved in some kind of drug activities and also into snuff movies, child trafficking, and so on. So my question is, once you look behind the structure of many of these major assassinations, you will see that many of them are very deeply involved in drugs and these snuff movies, child trafficking, awful, awful pedophile gangs, and so on. Very, very much connected into this whole military industrial complex, the Freemasonry networks, the whole structure behind the scenes. So is it possible, I'm just suggesting, is it possible that these serial killings are not the deed of a lone crazy man? We're talking about patsies again here. Not saying that these people are innocent, but I'm saying that it seems to me like many of these famous serial killers have had to take the credit for a lot more than was actually their deed. You look at what the witnesses see, you know, like with Ted Bundy and other serial killers, nobody saw him. Very often the description of the perpetrator was very different to the guy that had to take the fall for it. And also, once again, sometimes the killer was brutal serial killer was being protected. They were taking him for something else and let go right away, like if they had this invisible protection, instead of them being, as soon as they were, I mean, some of them were on the top wanted list of the FBI, were arrested and then let go of. What is that? Incredible when you look at it. And once again, very similar pattern to what is going on a regular basis when it comes to these people. If I can remind you of Operation 40, this team of top assassins that was created in the early 1960s, where Vice President Richard Nixon was given the task to put together a team of assassins that could be used to take out people globally, like presidents or dictators or whoever was their problem, wherever they wanted, in Latin America or whatever. He was put together, asked to form this team, and he gave the task to people like Ted Shackley, the Blonde Ghost in the CIA, E. Howard Hunt, very famous later for the Watergate burglary, the JFK assassination, and so on, and David Ackley Phillips, who was the controller of no less than Lee Harvey Oswald. He was also the controller of James Files, the man who is said to be standing behind the picket fence firing the last headshot at JFK, but also the controller of a mass murderer called Michael Vernon Townley, who 23 years after the JFK assassination was on location when the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme was taken out in Stockholm. you look at some of these people from Operation 40 and you will see that they have the exact same protection from the highest source. You have somebody like Orlando Bosch on my website, lightonconspiracies.com. You can find my book, Coup d'etat in slow motion. And in that book, it's about the assassination of Olof Palme, but with all the international connections into what we're talking now, into the JFK assassination, RFK, and so on. And one of the people involved in, or member of the Operation 40, was a man called Orlando Bosch. He was also called Dr. Death. And in my book, Coup d'etat in slow motion, just to show what type of people we're dealing with, I've listed the crimes that he was sentenced for, only the ones he was sentenced for, and it's like page up, page down, page up, page down, page up, page down, page up, page down, with different things, anything from blowing up people in cars to shooting down airliners to, you know, shooting with a bazooka on the UN building. These type of incredible things, most of them explosives. One of the people they killed was Orlando Letier on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C. But anyway, once he was in prison, what happened? He was pardoned by whom? George Bush Sr. This George Bush Sr., you will see that he is so central again and again and again and again and again. And this goes for the whole Bush family. Now George Bush Sr. is on the way out, and he has a whole long following, family that is moving in now. And I would strongly advise people to keep their eyes open when it comes to this, because that the level of criminality that this Bush family is involved in, unreal. I mean, it really makes Adolf Hitler almost look like a schoolboy. It is unheard of, the level that these people are involved in. And George Bush Sr. was the one. He was the paymaster as a young man for Operation 40, and he was using these people all the way through his whole career, one of them being Felix Rodriguez, who was very central, for instance, in the Iran-Contras. He was working side by side with Oliver North in the so-called Enterprise. He was also the man sent down to Bolivia together with another member from Operation 40, David Morales, to track down and kill Che Guevara, who was one of the associates of Fidel Castro, which they did. They tracked him down in the mountains of Bolivia. Felix Rodriguez gave the order to kill him, and David Morales was the one who shot him. And as far as I know, Felix Rodriguez to this very day is still wearing Che Guevara's rich watch. When it comes to David Morales, he was in Dealey Plaza when JFK was assassinated, and he was also at the Ambassador Hotel in 68 when Robert Kennedy was taken out. Same people, just in different location. He was later also named the top assassin of Latin America. I mean, big time players, these people. Big, big, big time. So, after the break, I'm going to go into a little more around this area, and I will show you some more incredible examples of how these people are being protected from the higher source. So, stay tuned.
Joan was quizzical, studied metaphysical science in the home. Late nights all alone with a test tube. Well, Edison, majoring in medicine, calls her on the phone. Can I take you out to the pictures, Joan? But as she's getting ready to go, a knock comes on the door. Bang, bang, Maxwell Silver. Back in school, a
desert scene. She tells Max to stay when the class is gone away, so he waits behind, writing 50 times, I must not be so, oh, oh, oh. But when she turns her back on the boy, he creeps up from behind.
Stem cell research, abortion, cloning, evolution, creation science, intelligent design. These are hot button issues today. Religion and science, morality and government, corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darwin. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin, at Amazon.com and the major bookstores. Render Unto Darwin.
Veer Radio is listener-supported. We need your donations to pay for live internet streaming radio, our toll-free call-in number, and our website, free MP3 archive links, and interactive forums. RevereRadioNetwork.com and click on the Make a Donation button.
Called serial killers. And the idea I would like to put forward is that is it possible that we are being fed a story, a lie, once again, same type of disinformation as in so many different areas of life, that these so-called serial killers are not always mad people, that some of them might be people programmed and used to kill, and some of them that have had to take the fall for crimes not committed by them. Quite a few of them claim to have been innocent. Some of them have been executed while being claiming to have been innocent. And quite a few mothers of some of the victims are now working legally for the aid of the accused. I mean, what type of mother would do that if she did not very strongly believe in the innocence of these people? Also, you and I, Jim, our friend Haley Otis, when she talks about the two people, Walt Stravinsky and Clyde Forshaw, she claims that especially Clyde has been very deeply involved in many of these so-called serial killer cases. Could that be true? I would say very worth looking into. Because when you look at especially what the witnesses have seen around these cases, very many times there's such weird things going on and such strange police work, such strange way of avoiding finding the real truth, and other times really nailing some what it appears to be innocent person for crimes that he did not commit. I would very much suggest that when you see this, see the type of killings, that maybe quite a few of them, quite a big percentage, have been contract hits, getting rid of competitors in drug business or different areas of life where they wanted to get rid of competitors or rivals or enemies, and then cover the whole thing up with totally senseless killings just to divert the attention away from the real purpose behind these assassinations or killings. Let's have a look at a few famous cases. In the States, you have people like Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole. Henry Lee Lucas, according to his own testimony at times, says that he has committed as many as up to 600 murders, between 300 and 600 murders. And very frequently he was working with his so-called partner Otis Toole, who is a self-described arsonist and cannibal, and they savagely murdered dozens of victims of various races, various ages, various genders, and so on. I mean, when you look at the brutality of these killings, absolutely awful, awful, awful. So, of course, once they got caught, I mean, death row was the next stop, the final stop on the road. Now, Henry Lee Lucas, he was scheduled for execution on June the 3rd, the 30th, 1998. At that time, no governor of any state at any time in history had carried out more execution than George Bush Jr. I mean, anyone there, even that, I know there was one case of a great grandmother who had defended herself against her very abusive husband. Even she had to fry, you know. And then comes Henry Lee Lucas. So of course he would be big time the one taking the seat, you know, right away for the next execution. Just 12 days before the execution, Governor George Bush Jr. made a special request to the State Board of Pardons and Paroles, where all the members were Bush appointees. He then made Henry Lee Lucas become the first and ultimately only recipient of mercy, on the ground that Lucas might be innocent. I mean, come on, listen to it. It's unreal. So, the only one that was let off death row was Henry Lee Lucas, self-confessed mass murderer. What does that tell you? You have his father, George Bush Sr., who has pardoned other serial killers like Orlando Bosch, Luis Posada Carillas, incredibly violent people. So what is going on here? Then you have Otis Toole, his partner. What happened for him? He was also up for being fried. Where? Florida. Who is the governor? Jeb Bush, brother of George Bush Jr. So what happened to Otis? The exact same thing happened there. What are we looking at? What are we looking at? I would very strongly suggest that here is such a clear pattern that these people have been used to eliminate people in the hundreds, and now suddenly they need to be protected. So we look at another case. You have Rafael Resendez Ramirez. He was also one. He had committed at least 9 murders. He was on the top 10 list of wanted people. So what happened? He had been taken into custody several weeks by the U.S. Border Patrol, only to be promptly released, despite being on the FBI's most wanted list. Then he went to Mexico, where it's a country with no death penalty, and entered the execution capital of the Western world into Texas. He came walking across the bridge, walking into Juarez, from Juarez into El Paso, and turned himself in. What is going on? Once again, if you look at it logically, here is a person who is doing everything he can to get into safe country for him, safe, a way where that would be safe for him. So he enters the death capital of the world, Texas, because he knows he has protection there. And he insists on being on surrendering to a Texas Ranger. So what are we looking at? Again, this is the so-called Night Stalker in Los Angeles. When you look at the things that he was accused of, most victims had contact wounds with a 22 or 25 while sleeping. The remaining victims were blundered on or stabbed with weapons of opportunity, the exact same things as was recommended by the CIA. Then, do you know, if you look in history, it's so strange when you look into some of these very, very famous cases, like you had the Charles Lindbergh kidnapping, if you remember that one. That was way many, many years back in the 1920s. You had Charles Lindbergh, who was very famous for having crossed, the first pilot to have crossed the Atlantic Sea in a plane. He, officially, his son was kidnapped. They had moved into a new house, and his baby boy was being kidnapped from a man. I think he was later, the gardener was accused for it, and he later was executed for it. But when you look into the case, we are back to very, very strange circumstances surrounding that one as well. A few months before this happened, Charles Lindbergh had hidden his own child in a cupboard, telling the staff of the house that the child had been kidnapped. So everybody freaked out, panicked, until 20 minutes later he brought out the child and said, no, I was only kidding. Almost like a rehearsal of the exact same thing that then later happened. the staff, the people who were there close to Charles Lindbergh, said that he did not show any emotional reaction whatsoever when it came to this case. And the identical thing happened, that he had been kidnapped. And the whole thing afterwards, where the evidence, everything that would point it out at this poor guy, a German immigrant, I believe, was so strange. You know, like the investigators, they moved into the house where this man was living, threw him out, and then that is exactly from where the evidence, a so-called stepladder, was found that had to have been manufactured. So, I mean, the chances of the people moving in, of them having manufactured this evidence, is quite big when you look at it, because it was only after they moved in that this ladder was found. Anyway, you look at Charles Lindbergh's behavior, and who were the people he called straight away before he had said to the staff and his family that the child could not be disturbed before 10 p.m. What parent would not disturb a child before 10 p.m., but after? I mean, a normal behavior would be that the child was awake during the day and then keep him awake so that he would sleep at night. Here, the absolute opposite. And then the people that he called, as soon as it was discovered, before they even started looking for the child, it was like, he's been kidnapped. That's it. So he grabs the phone and he calls people like Wild Bill Donovan from the CIA, very central in the OSS, very central behind the JFK assassination and so on. Also, very historical person in this whole web of conspiracies globally. And another one, the one he called straight after that, was Norman Schwarzkopf, which was the father of Norman Schwarzkopf, the guy that together with George Bush went to rape and plunder in Iraq. Same historical people turning up again in another of these mysteries, global mysteries. Very, very odd. And if you look at many of the things that the CIA use and so on, when it comes to these things, they use an old Roman tactic called problem, reaction, solution. They secretly create a problem to get a reaction from the public. The reaction they always want is like, oh my God, something needs to be done. And then the public, the population of the country will turn towards the same people who secretly created a problem, who can then serve the solution. And so many of these things, when it has come to inflict fear on society in so many different ways, I would suggest that many of these things have been committed by these people. They secretly created the problems, these awful acts of terror, these awful mass shootings, these awful assassinations and so on, to get this emotional outcry from the public so that they could come and serve the solution. You look at modern day today in the States, who would have accepted waterboarding, torture, drone shooting absolute innocent people, people being arrested right, left and center, guillotines, FEMA camps, SWAT teams, people looking like police looking like Robocops driving around in tanks in the streets of the US. I mean, who would have even thought it would be possible before 9/11 and so on? I just want to point out one final thing before I will leave you with these thoughts. But do you know, in 1966, we're back into the same time as so many of these other things happened. There was a former U.S. Marine sharpshooter by the name of Charles Whitman. He was trained at the Naval Enlisted Science Education Program, and he ascended the tower of the University of Texas in Austin. We're back to Texas. Let me just point out also, when it comes to many of these major assassinations, and also the areas that are very central in And behind the JFK assassination, many of the other assassinations, the whole drug epidemic, how this whole thing was started. The centers for most of these things were Texas, Florida, Chicago, and California. Look at who are controlling these areas, and you will see that the Bush family are very, very strong in these areas, combined with the mob and the other power constellations they have. So here we are back in Texas, here in Austin. It was on August the 1st, 1966, where this former Marine sharpshooter, Charles Whitman, is said to have ascended the tower of the university. He carried single-handedly a heavy footlocker loaded with three rifles, three handguns, a sawed-off shotgun, 700 rounds of ammo, two knives, food and water for several days, gasoline, a clock, radio, compass, that is really good when you're going up into a tower, a hammer, a hatchet, and various other items. He carried them up himself unnoticed with all of these weapons, all of that. And then for 1.5 hours, he was lying up there shooting totally wild at lots and lots of people. There are many different accounts. I haven't been able to establish how many were actually shot, but it seems like somewhere around 14 people were killed and 31 wounded. When you speak to the or you talk to the witnesses, most of them say that they thought that there were multiple shooters, that there were shots being fired in different directions at the same time. So we are back to strange things happening around these so-called mass shootings and so on, and where a lone person is being accused of this. Of course, he also was found, he killed himself, they say, after this. It's said that he hated his abusive father, but when you look at it, the people that was killed around him was his mother and wife. Don't you think it would be more logical if he had killed his abusive father, not his mother and wife? Here's the other way around. Mother and wife killed, and himself. The reason why I mention this case is that the Whitman attack marked a new and different so-called terror. That was the first time where everyone could be killed at random. We're back to the strategy of tension, I would suggest. And this prompted many police departments to develop the first SWAT teams. This shooting that is blamed on one guy, one crazy guy, was the thing that started the first SWAT teams. Then these are the teams that we see everywhere nowadays. Even in small little towns, they've got SWAT teams to raid people with vitamins and who are collecting rainwater. I don't know what kind of craziness that is going on at the moment. This is where the SWAT teams come in. And we're so used to seeing them everywhere, in every single film, movie, and so on. Same type of thing. Problem, reaction, solution. And once the solution is in place, you just step it up. You know, so you just keep it there, make people used to see them, and they're all the time there for your protection. Because this whole thing is for your protection and national security. I would say national security has nothing to do with national security. It is for you, the normal person, to not be able to look into what these highly, highly, highly criminal people are carrying out behind your back and totally destroying your life without you knowing it. So I very much suggest to say it's a high time to wake up. This is an incredible time to wake up as well, because this is when it's all happening. This is where, when we are going to see that this whole shift is going to take place. Because in my opinion, this cabal is going down, the awakening that is going on globally now, and the way that the spotlight is being aimed at this small, small so-called power elite, I call them the minority normally, the spotlight is being aimed right at them, and they're being neutralized just by being exposed, because they have only been able to get away with all these awful atrocities because they've been hiding in the dark, hiding in the shadows, very, very cowardly. But now the time is changing, the tide is changing, and in my humble opinion, we're looking at a super positive and beautiful future. We just have to transcend this obstacle. We have to transcend it in a non-violent way. If we use violence, that is their ballpark. It is their language, and they will squash us if we try to do it. We have to expose them instead and let the truth do the work. So by that, if anyone would like to support my type of research, my website is lightonconspiracies.com. Any type of support financially is greatly appreciated. Buy my book, sign up for my newsletter, become a member, and so on. Very, very appreciated. And also, I would once again like to mention David McGowan, incredible research. Some of his books are Weird Secrets of the Canyon and Programmed to Kill. Highly recommended books. And with that, I...
Now, you lads, have you just shouted Happy Christmas for us into this cave?
Happy Christmas?
Yeah. Got one, two, three.
Happy Christmas.
Thank you, same to you. Happy Christmas.
Garden with your wife Yoko, but do you have any special thoughts for Christmas?
Well, Yoko, it is Christmas, and my special thoughts, of course, tend towards eating.
All right, so eating. Well, what do you like to eat?
Well, I'd like some cornflakes prepared by Parisian hands, and I'd like it blessed by Hare Krishna mantra.
Have a wonderful Christmas.
Have a jolly new year.
Make sure that Christmas
comes once again.
Yes, happy new year, all of us.
This is George Harrison saying happy Christmas. Happy Christmas. 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 Happy, happy.
Oh, good evening to you, Gene. Good evening to you, gentlemen. Happy to be here. Good evening to you, gentlemen. I fear. Good evening to one and all. I hope you will enjoy the coming sports day of our life is Mama's little boy.
So, how do you like the garden here?
I think it's simply splendid. I'm overwhelmed by its sanctuary.
So, you don't mind this, high gates and things, I mean the wall, the surrounding.
Oh, I always loved the high walls. The Elizabethan high wall is something I've always loved. You see?
Yes.
Lady.
That I hope everybody listening to this has a very happy time at Christmas and has a good, fortunate, lucky new year, and a good time to be had by all. Merry Christmas.
Merry, Merry Christmas. This is to wish you.
Happy New Year.
Now, how do you see your place in the 70s to come? We've had the swinging 60s, and I was wondering, Mrs. Lennon, how you saw your place in the 70s.
I think it'll be a quiet, peaceful 70s, hopefully, you know.
You think there's going to be peace, do you?
Yes, and freedom.
I see.
Freedom of mind and everything.
I see. Very nice.
Everybody will just be flying around, you know.
Everybody will just be flying around, you see. You understand that?
The air is so crisp and all that, and just there's something
deep
about it.
Deep and crisp
delicate.
And even.
And
brightly
sort of,
shone the moon last night.
Like
the frost
a strange
moon.
Magic, you know, just slowing down the process of our thinking.
Being
you know,
off you.
Beautiful.
Oh, well. Good King Wenceslas last looked out on the feast of Happy Christmas. Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas. Happy Christmas.
Oh, oh,
oh, oh. Happy Christmas.
John,
you're home.
John.
Happy Christmas.
It's warm and nice and comfy.
DC.
Let's put the light on the trees.
All right, dear. You pass me the light, and I'll stick it on the tree.
Merry Christmas, 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 Magic Christian, Magic Christian, Magic Christian, Magic Christian. It's just a plug for the film, Ken. Try and keep it on. This is Ringo saying a Merry Christmas to everybody and a very Happy New Year.
I'd like a big teddy.
I get you a bling-bling teddy then.
Oh, thank you, Mommy.
Yeah, good boy, John.
Oh, yes, Mommy, I will. As long as you get me a teddy bear.
A teddy bear?
And a train set.
A milking train set, then.
And a man on the moon that goes on the moon and down to the moon.
An ice cream moon.
That's right. And lots 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 and lots.